This is Audible.
The Alienist by Caleb Carr. Prior to the 20th century, persons suffering from mental illness were thought to be alienated, not only from the rest of society, but from their own true natures. Those experts who studied mental pathologies were therefore known as alienists. January 8th, 1919. Theodore is in the ground. The words as I write them make as little sense as did the sight of his coffin descending into a patch of sandy soil near Sagamore Hill, the place he loved more than any other on earth. As I stood there this afternoon, in the cold January wind that blew off Long Island Sound, I thought to myself, of course it's a joke. Of course he'll burst the lid open, blind us all with that ridiculous grin, and split our ears with that high-pitched bark of laughter. Then he'll exclaim that there's work to do, action to get, as he called it. And we'll all be marshaled to the task of protecting some obscure species of newt from the ravages of a predatory industrial giant. I was not alone in such fantasies. Everyone at the funeral expected something of the kind. It was plain on their faces. All reports indicate that most of the country and much of the world feel the same way. The notion of Theodore Roosevelt being gone is that. Unacceptable. I dined with Laszlo Kreitzler at Delmonico's last night. Kreitzler. He didn't want to attend the funeral, though Edith Roosevelt would have liked him to. She has always been truly partial to the man she calls the Enigma, the brilliant doctor whose studies of the human mind have disturbed so many people so profoundly over the last 40 years. Kreitzler wrote Edith a note explaining that he did not much like the idea of a world without Theodore, and being as he's now 64 and has spent his life staring ugly realities full in the face, he thinks he'll just indulge himself and ignore the fact of his friend's passing. Some of the boys from the Times wanted me to come to a memorial dinner tonight, but a quiet evening at Delmonico's with Kreitzler seemed much more the appropriate thing. It wasn't out of nostalgia for any shared boyhood in New York that we raised our glasses, because Laszlo and Theodore didn't actually meet until Harvard. No, Kreitzler and I were fixing our hearts on the spring of 1896, nearly a quarter of a century ago, and on a series of events that still seems too bizarre to have occurred even in this city. By the end of our dessert and Madeira, the two of us were laughing and shaking our heads, amazed to this day that we were able to get through the ordeal with our skins. There's no simple way to describe it. I could say in retrospect it seems that all three of our lives, and those of many others, led inevitably and fatefully to that one experience. But then I'd be broaching the subject of psychological determinism and questioning man's free will, reopening, in other words, the philosophical conundrum that wove irrepressibly in and out of the nightmarish proceedings, like the only hummable tune in a difficult opera. Or I could say that during the course of those months, Roosevelt, Kreitzler, and I, assisted by some of the best people I've ever known, set out on the trail of a murderous monster and ended up face to face with a frightened child. But that would be deliberately vague. No, there's only one way to do it, and that's to tell the whole thing, going back to the first grisly night and that first butchered body. Yes, to dredge it all up and put it finally before the public. That's the way. It's been concern about public reaction that's forced us to keep the story secret for so many years. Theodore knew that the American people were not ready to hear the truth at the time. I wonder if they are now. Kreitzler doubts it. I told him I intended to write the story, and he gave me one of his sardonic chuckles and said that it would only frighten and repel people, nothing more. The country, he declared tonight, really hasn't changed much since 1896. We're all still running, according to Kreitzler. In our private moments, we Americans are running just as fast and fearfully as we were then, running away from the darkness we know to lie behind so many apparently tranquil household doors. away from the nightmares that continue to be injected into children's skulls by people whom nature tells them they should love and trust, running ever faster and in ever greater numbers towards those potions, powders, priests, and philosophies that promise to obliterate such fears and nightmares and ask in return only slavish devotion. Can Kreitzler truly be right? But I wax ambiguous. To the beginning, then. An ungodly pummeling on the door of my grandmother's house at 19 Washington Square North brought first the maid and then my grandmother herself to the doorways of their bedrooms at 2 o'clock on the morning of March 3rd, 1896. I lay in bed in that no longer drunk yet not quite sober state which is usually softened by sleep, knowing that whoever was at the door probably had business with me rather than my grandmother. I burrowed into my linen-cased pillows, hoping that he'd just give up and go away.
"Mrs. Moore, it's a fearful racket. Shall I answer it, then?"
"You shall not. Wake my grandson, Harriet. Doubtless he's forgotten the gambling debt." Then I heard footsteps heading toward my room and decided I'd better get ready. Since the demise of my engagement to Miss Julia Pratt of Washington some 2 years earlier, I'd been staying with my grandmother, and during that time the old girl had become steadily more skeptical about the ways in which I spent my off hours. I had repeatedly explained that as police reporter for the New York Times, I was required to visit many of the city's senior districts and consort with some less than savory characters. But she remembered my youth too well to accept that admittedly strained story. My homecoming deportment on the average evening generally reinforced her suspicion that it was state of mind, not professional obligation, that drew me to the dance halls and gaming tables of the Tenderloin every night. And I realized, having caught the gambling remark just made to Harriet, that it was now crucial to project the image of a sober man with serious concerns. I shot into a black Chinese robe, forced my short hair down on my head, and opened the door loftily just as Harriet reached it. "Ah, Harriet, no need for alarm. I was just reviewing some notes for a story and found I needed some materials from the office. Doubtless that's the boy with them now." I went quickly but cautiously to the bottom of the staircase, where I realized that in fact I knew the voice that was calling for me, but couldn't identify it precisely. Nor was I reassured by the fact that it was a young voice. Some of the most vicious thieves and killers I'd encountered in the New York of 1896 were mere striplings. "Mr. Moore?" The young man added a few healthy kicks to his knocks. "I must talk to Mr. John Schuyler Moore." I stood on the black and white marble floor of the vestibule, one hand on the lock of the door. "Who's there?"
"It's me, sir. Stevie, sir."
I breathed a slight sigh of relief and unlocked the heavy wooden portal. Outside, standing in the dim light of an overhead gas lamp, the only one in the house that my grandmother had refused to have replaced with an electric bulb, was Stevie Taggart, the Steve Pipe, as he was known. In his first 11 years, Stevie had risen to become the bane of 15 police precincts. But he'd then been reformed by, and was now a driver and general errand boy for, the eminent physician and alienist, my good friend, Dr. Laszlo Kreitzler. Stevie leaned against one of the white columns outside the door and tried to catch his breath. Something had clearly terrified the lad. "Stevie, what's happened?" His long sheet of straight brown hair was matted with sweat. Looking beyond him, I saw Kreitzler's small Canadian calash. The cover of the black carriage was folded down, and the rig was drawn by a matching gelding called Frederick. The animal was, like Stevie, bathed in sweat, which steamed in the early March air.
"The doctor says you're to come with me, right away."
"But where? It's 2 in the morning.
"Right away!"
He was obviously in no condition to explain, so I told him to wait while I put on some clothes. As I did so, my grandmother shouted through my bedroom door that whatever that peculiar Dr. Kreisler and I were up to at 2 in the morning, she was sure it was not respectable. Ignoring her as best I could, I got back outside, pulling my tweed coat close as I jumped into the carriage. I didn't even have time to sit before Stevie lashed at Frederick with a long whip, falling back into the dark maroon leather of the seat. I thought to upbraid the boy, but again the look of fear in his face struck me. I braced myself as the carriage careened at a somewhat alarming pace over the cobblestones of Washington Square. The shaking and jostling eased only marginally as we turned onto the long, wide slabs of rust pavement on Broadway. We were heading downtown, downtown and east, into that quarter of Manhattan where Laszlo Kreitzler plied his trade, and where life became, the further one progressed into the area, ever cheaper and more sordid, the Lower East Side. For a moment I thought that perhaps something had happened to Laszlo. Certainly that would have accounted for the fretful way in which Stevie whipped and drove Frederick, an animal I knew him at most times to treat with complete kindness. "Stevie, where is Dr. Kreitzler? Is he all right?"
"He's at the Institute."
Laszlo's work was based in the Kreitzler Institute for Children, a combination of school and research center that he had founded during the 80s. The families he worked with ranged from the wealthiest in the Northeast to the poorest of urban immigrants. But they all had one thing in common, a troubled or troublesome child, whose behavior was in some way extreme and inexplicable. After investigation, Kreitzler often discovered that the child had been abused in his or her family. If Kreitzler thought he could do some good in the case, the child would be enrolled. He or she would live at the Institute nearly full time, going home only for holidays, and then only if Kreitzler thought such contact safe. Allowing troubled children a new environmental context was the most important goal of the Institute, and beyond that, it was the cornerstone of Laszlo's passionate effort to discover whether or not what he called the original mold of the human psyche could be recast, and the fate to which the accidents of birth consign each of us thereby redetermined. Much of society did not approve of Kreitzler's methods. I'd even heard him accused of stealing children from their homes. When Laszlo and I were at Harvard, he and the great psychologist William James had battled over whether or not any of us are free to determine what kind of lives we will lead as adults. James championed the idea of free will. I confess that even I was torn between loyalty to Laszlo, a lifelong friend whose beliefs had nonetheless made me uneasy, and enthusiasm for James's philosophy, which seemed to offer the promise of limitless possibilities for not only my own, but every man's future. I put these thoughts aside and made an attempt to communicate with my driver. "Stevie, are we going to the Institute too?" But Stevie only reined the horse sharply left at Spring Street, where we disrupted business outside two or three concert saloons, houses of assignation where prostitutes who passed themselves off as dancers made arrangements for later meetings at cheap hotels with hapless fools who were generally from out of town. From Spring, Stevie made his way to Delancey Street, which was in the midst of being widened to accommodate the expected traffic of the new Williamsburg Bridge, whose construction had only recently begun. Echoing down from each passing side street, I could hear the desperate, demented sounds of the dives. Filthy holes that sold rot-gut liquor laced with everything from benzene to camphor for a nickel a glass atop a dirty plank that passed for a bar. Stevie did not slacken the pace. We were headed, it seemed, for the very edge of the island. A vast, maudlin sea of small shacks and shoddy new tenements stretched away to either side of us. The area was a stewpot of different immigrant cultures and languages. An occasional church of some denomination or other was visible among the rows upon rows of dismal residences, which even on this crisp morning were draped with lines of laundry. Some pieces of clothing and bedding, frozen almost solid, twisted in the wind stiffly at what might have seemed unnatural angles. But in truth, nothing in such a place, where furtive souls scurried from darkened doorways to blackened alleys, wrapped in what were often little more than rags, their feet bare to the frozen horse manure, urine, and soot that coated the streets, could truly be called unnatural. We were in a neighborhood that knew little of laws, man-made or otherwise, a neighborhood that gave joy to visitors and residents only when they were allowed to view its recession in the distance after making their escape. Near the end of Delancey Street, the smells of sea and fresh water, along with the stench of refuse that those who lived near the waterfront simply dumped off the edge of Manhattan every day, mingled to produce the distinctive aroma of that tidal pool we call the East River. A large structure soon slanted up before us, the ramp approached to the nascent Williamsburg Bridge. Without pausing and much to my dismay, Stevie crashed onto the boarded roadway, the horse's hooves and carriage wheels clattering far more loudly against wood than they had against stone. An elaborate maze of steel supports below the roadway bore us dozens of feet up into the night air. As I wondered what our destination could possibly be, for the towers of the bridge were nothing like completed, and the structure's opening was years away, I began to make out what looked like the walls of a large Chinese temple suddenly looming ahead. Composed of huge granite blocks and crowned by two squat watchtowers, each of which was ringed by a delicate steel walkway, this peculiar edifice was the Manhattan side anchor of the bridge, the structure that would eventually hold one set of the ends of the enormous steel suspension cables that would support the central span. In a way, though, my impression of it as a temple was not far off the mark. Like the Brooklyn Bridge, whose Gothic arches I could see silhouetted against the night sky to the south, this new roadway over the East River was a place where many workers' lives had been sacrificed to the faith of engineering, which in the past 15 years had produced towering marvels all over Manhattan. What I did not know was that the blood sacrifice that had been made atop the western anchor of the Williamsburg Bridge on that particular night was of a very different nature. Near the entrance to the watchtowers atop the anchor, standing under the flimsy light of a few electric bulbs and bearing portable lanterns, were several patrolmen whose small brass insignia marked them as coming from the 13th Precinct. With them was a sergeant from the 15th, a fact that immediately struck me as odd. In 2 years of covering the criminal beat for the Times, not to mention a childhood in New York, I'd learned that each of the city's police precincts guarded its terrain jealously. For the 13th to have summoned a man from the 15th indicated that something significant was going on. Stevie finally reined the gelding up near this group of blue greatcoats. He nodded to the northern watchtower, then pulled a battered cigarette out of his pocket. "Up there. The doctor says you're to go up." I started for the doorway in the granite wall, but Stevie stayed with the horse. "You're not coming?" The boy shuddered and turned away, lighting the cigarette. "I seen it once, and if I never see such again, I'll be done right. When you're ready to get back home, Mr. Moore, I'll be right here. Doctor's instructions." I felt increased apprehension as I turned and headed for the doorway, where I was stopped by the arm of the police sergeant. "And who might you be, with the young Steve Pipe driving you around past all respectable hours? This is a crime scene, you know." I gave the man my name and occupation, at which he grinned and showed me an impressive gold tooth. "Ah, a gentleman of the press, and the Times, no less. Well, Mr. Moore, I've just arrived myself. Urgent call. Apparently no other man they could trust. Ah. Come on, up we go, sir. And mind, it's dark as the pit in here." So it was. I stumbled and tripped my way up a rough flight of stairs, at the top of which I could make out the form of another leatherhead. The cop, a roundsman from the 13th Precinct, turned on our approach and then called to someone else. "It's Sergeant Flynn, sir. He's here." We came out of the stairs into a small room littered with sawhorses, planks of wood, buckets of rivets, and bits of metal and wiring. Wide windows gave a full view of the horizon in every direction. The city behind us, the river, and the partially completed towers of the bridge before us. A doorway led out onto the walkway that ran around the tower. Near the doorway stood a slit-eyed, bearded sergeant of detectives named Patrick Connor, whom I recognized from my visits to police headquarters on Mulberry Street. Next to him, looking out over the river with his hands clasped behind his back, rocking on the balls of his feet, was a much more familiar figure. Theodore.
"Sergeant Flynn?" Roosevelt spoke without turning around. "It's ghastly work that has prompted our call, I'm afraid. Ghastly."
My discomfort suddenly heightened when Theodore spun to face us. There was nothing unusual in his appearance. An expensive, slightly dandy, checked suit, the spectacles that were, like the eyes behind them, too small for his tough, square head, the broad mustache bristling below the wide nose. Yet his visage was excessively odd, nonetheless. Then it occurred to me. His teeth. His numerous, usually snapping teeth. They were nowhere in sight. His jaws were clamped shut in what seemed passionate anger. Or remorse. Something had shaken Roosevelt badly. His dismay seemed to grow when he saw me.
"What? Moore? What in thunder are you doing here?"
"Well, I'm glad to see you too, Roosevelt." I extended a hand. He accepted it, though for once he didn't loosen my arm from its socket.
"What? Oh, I am sorry, Moore. Delighted to see you, of course, delighted, but who told you?"
"Told me what?" I was abducted and brought here by Kreitzler's boy, on his orders, without so much as a word of explanation. Roosevelt glanced out of the window with a confounded and even fearful look that was not at all typical of him.
Kreitzler. Yes, Kreitzler's been here before I arrived. He left a note and a report.
Theodore revealed a piece of paper clutched in his left hand.
A preliminary one, at any rate. He was the first doctor they could find in this neighborhood, although it was quite hopeless.
I took him by the shoulder.
Roosevelt, what is it?
He indicated the door to the outer walkway. Detective Sergeant Connor stepped aside, and then Flynn led the way out. My first thought on emerging, despite my apprehension, was that the view from the walkway was even more extraordinary than that from the tower windows. Across the water lay Williamsburg, since a peaceful country town, but now rapidly becoming a bustling part of the metropolis that was destined, within months, to officially evolve into Greater New York. To the south, the Brooklyn Bridge. In the southwestern distance, the new towers of Printing House Square, and below us, the churning black waters of the river. And then I saw it.
Odd how long it took my mind to make any sense of the image.
Or perhaps not. There was so much so very wrong, so very out of place, so distorted. How could I have expected myself to grasp it quickly? On the walkway was the body of a young person. I say person because, though the physical attributes were those of an adolescent boy, the clothes, little more than a chemise that was missing a sleeve, and the facial paint were those of a girl, or rather of a woman, and a woman of dubious repute at that. The unfortunate creature's wrists were trussed behind the back, and the legs were bent in a kneeling position that pressed the face to the steel of the walkway. There was no sign of any pants or shoes, just one sock hanging pathetically from a foot. But what had been done to the body? The face did not seem heavily beaten or bruised. The paint and powder were still intact. But where once there had been eyes, there were now only bloody, cavernous sockets. A puzzling piece of flesh protruded from the mouth. A wide gash stretched across the throat, though there was little blood near the opening. Large cuts crisscrossed the abdomen, revealing the mass of the inner organs. The right hand had been chopped neatly off. At the groin there was another gaping wound, one that explained the mouth. The genitals had been cut away and stuffed between the jaws. The buttocks, too, had been shorn off in what appeared large, one could only call them carving strokes. In the minute or two that it took me to note all these details, the vista around me faded into a sea of indistinguishable blackness, and what I thought was the churning progress of a ship turned out to be my own blood in my ears. With a sudden realization that I might be sick, I spun to grasp the railing of the walkway and hung my head out over the water. Theodore reached me in a quick bound.
"Easy now, John."
He supported me with that wiry yet remarkably strong boxer's frame of his.
"Breathe deeply."
As I followed his instructions, I heard a long, trailing whistle from Flynn, who continued to stare at the body.
"Well, now, somebody has done for you, young Giorgio called Gloria, haven't they?"
He addressed the corpse without sounding particularly concerned.
"You're a hell of a mess." "Then you know the child, Flynn?"
Theodore leaned me against the wall of the watchtower. Steadiness was returning to my head. Flynn seemed in the dim light to be smiling.
"That I do, Commissioner. Though it was no child, this one, not if childhood be judged by behavior. Family name Santarelli. Must have been, 13 years old or thereabouts. Giorgio it was called originally, and since it began working out of Parisis Hall, it called itself Gloria."
I wiped cold sweat from my forehead with the cuff of my coat.
"It? Why do you call him it?"
Flynn's smile became a grin.
"And what would you call it, Mr. Moore? It warn't no male, not to judge by its antics. But God didn't create it female, tither. They're all its to me, that breed."
Theodore's hands went forcefully to his hips, the fingers curling up into fists.
I'm not interested in your philosophical analysis, Sergeant. Whatever else, the boy was a child, and the child has been murdered.
Flynn chuckled and glanced again at the body.
No arguing that, sir.
Theodore barked at Flynn.
Sergeant! Not another word from you, sir. I'll let us to answer my questions. Understood?
Flynn nodded. But the cynical, amused resentment that all long-time officers in the department felt for the commissioner, who in just 1 year had stood police headquarters and the whole chain of departmental command on its ear, remained evident in the slightest curl of his upper lip. Theodore could not have missed it.
Now then, you say the boy was called Giorgio Santarelli, and that he worked out of Parisa's Hall. That's Biff Ellison's establishment on Cooper Square, correct?
That'd be the one, Commissioner.
And where would you guess that Mr. Ellison is at this moment?
At this? Why, in the hall itself, sir.
Go there. Tell him I want him at Mulberry Street tomorrow morning.
For the first time, Flynn looked concerned. Tomorrow? Now, begging your pardon, Commissioner, but Mr. Ellison's not the sort of man to take that kind of a summons sweetly.
Then arrest him.
Arrest him? Sure, Commissioner, if we arrested every owner of a bar or disorderly house that harbors boy whores just because one gets roughed up or even murdered, why, sir, we'd never...
Perhaps you would like to tell me the real reason for your resistance?
Theodore's fists started to flex behind his back. He walked right up and put his spectacles in Flynn's face.
Is Mr. Ellison not one of your primary sources of graft?
Flynn's eyes widened, but he managed to draw himself up haughtily and affect wounded pride.
Mr. Roosevelt, I've been on the force for 15 years, sir, and I think I know how this city works. You don't go harassing a man like Mr. Ellison just because some little piece of immigrant trash finally gets what's coming to it.
That was all, and I knew that was all, and it was fortunate for Roosevelt that I did. For had I not shot over at just that moment to grab his arms, he would certainly have beaten Flynn into a bloody pulp. It was a struggle, though, to keep hold of those strong arms. I spoke into his ear.
No, Roosevelt, no. It's what his kind want. You know that. Attack a man in uniform and they'll have your head. There'll be nothing the mayor can do about it.
Roosevelt was breathing hard, and Flynn was once again smiling.
A simple choice for you, Flynn. Ellison in my office or your badge on my desk. Tomorrow morning.
Sure.
Commissioner?
Flynn spun on his heel and headed back down the watchtower steps, mumbling something about, damn society boy playing a policeman. One of the cops who had been positioned below the tower then appeared to say that a coroner's wagon had arrived and was ready to haul the body away. Roosevelt told them to wait a few minutes, and then dismissed Connor and the roundsman as well. We were now alone on the walkway, except for the ghoulish remains of what had once been, apparently, another of the many desperately troubled young people who every season were spat up by the dark, miserable tenement ocean that stretched away from us to the west. Forced to use whatever means they could, and Giorgio Santarelli's had been the most basic, to survive on their own, such children were more completely alone than anyone unfamiliar with the New York City ghettos of 1896 could possibly imagine. Theodore glanced at the sheet of paper in his hand.
Kreitzler estimates that the boy was killed earlier tonight. Something about the temperature of the body. So the killer may still be in the area. I have men combing it. There are a few other medical details, and then this message.
He handed the paper to me, and on it I saw scrawled in Kreitzler's agitated hand,
Roosevelt, terrible errors have been made. I will be available in the morning. We should begin. There is a timetable.
I tried for a moment to make sense of it. It's fairly tiresome of him to be so cryptic.
Yes, I thought so, too. But I think I understand, now that I've examined the body. Already this year we've had 2 such cases, boys like this, found in the streets.
Were they both left this way?
Virtually. Throats cut, and they'd both been gotten at by the rats and birds, like this one. Didn't make it an easy sight.
Rats and birds? Roosevelt sighed.
The eyes. Detective Sergeant Connor puts that down to rats, or carrion pickers.
There hadn't been anything in the papers about these other 2 killings, although there was nothing surprising about that. Murders that occurred among the poor or outcast were barely recorded, much less investigated by the police. and when the victims were members of the segment of society that was not generally acknowledged to exist, then the chances of public awareness shrank from slim to none. I wondered for a moment what my own editors at the Times would have done if I'd suggested running a story about a young boy who made his living painting himself like a female whore and selling his body to grown men, many of them ostensibly respectable men, and who was horribly butchered in a dark corner of the city. I would have been lucky to escape with a dismissal. Forced internment at the Bloomingdale Asylum would have been the more likely result. Roosevelt tried to rouse himself.
I haven't spoken to Kreitzler in years. Still, the good doctor must have called you here for a reason, Moore.
I'm deuced if I can see it.
Yes, as inscrutable as any Chinaman, our friend Kreitzler. But I think I may be able to divine his purpose. You see, Moore, I've had to ignore the other killings like this one because there's no desire to investigate them in the department. Even if there were, none of our detectives is trained to make sense of such butchery. But this boy, this horrible, bloody mess, justice can only be blind so long. I've a scheme. And I think Kreitzler has a scheme, and I think you're the one to bring us together. Bring him to my office tomorrow. But mind you, be discreet. As far as anyone else is concerned, it's a social reunion of old friends. Action, Moore. We shall respond with action.
And then he grabbed me around the shoulders in a tight hug, his enthusiasm and moral certainty all back in full force. As for my own sense of certainty, any kind of certainty, I waited in vain for its arrival. All I knew was that I was being drawn into something that involved the two most passionately determined men I'd ever known, and that thought offered me no comfort as we went back downstairs to Kreitzler's carriage, leaving the body of the pitiable Santarelli boy alone in the tower, high in the freezing sky that was still untouched by any trace of dawn. Cold, cutting March rain came with the morning. I met Kreitzler outside police headquarters on Mulberry Street. As usual, his suit and coat were black, and as so often, he was reading the music notices in the Times. His black eyes, so much like a large bird's, flitted about the paper as he shifted from one foot to the other in sudden, quick movements. He held the Times in his right hand, and his left arm, underdeveloped as the result of a childhood injury, was pulled in close to his body. The left hand occasionally rose to swipe at his neatly trimmed mustache and the small patch of beard under his lower lip. His dark hair, cut far too long to meet the fashion of the day and swept back on his head, was moist, for he always went hatless, and this, along with the bobbing of his face at the pages before him, only increased the impression of some hungry, restless hawk determined to wring satisfaction from the worrisome world around him. Standing next to Kreitzler was the enormous Cyrus Montrose, Laszlo's valet, occasional driver, effective bodyguard, and alter ego. Like most of Kreitzler's employees, Cyrus was a former patient, one who had made me more than a little nervous, despite his apparently controlled manner and appearance. That morning he was dressed in gray pants and a tightly buttoned brown jacket, and his broad black features did not seem even to register my approach. But as I came closer, he tapped Kreitzler on the arm and silently pointed my way.
Ah, Moore, splendid!
Kreitzler's words bore the lilt of a European accent. He had emigrated to the United States as a child, when his German father, a wealthy publisher and 1848 Republican, and his Hungarian mother had fled monarchist persecution to begin a somewhat celebrated life in New York as fashionable political exiles.
Shall we go in?
Before we were inside the door, however, we were waylaid by my fellow journalists Link Steffens and Jake Reese, who wanted confirmation of certain rumors and speculations that Detective Sergeant Connor, who'd been at the scene the previous night, had shared with them. Genuine alarm came into Kreitzler's face.
No, no, he mustn't. It is absolutely vital that he not spread such stories.
Laszlo bolted inside just as Steffens made a final attempt to get him to talk. Then Steffens grabbed my arm.
Can't you tell us anything, John?
I thought for just a moment of the corpse on the bridge anchor. However ungodly the rumors, boys, they can't begin to describe it. At that, I turned and strode inside. I found Kreitzler standing near the caged elevator talking heatedly with Connor. I was about to join them when my arm was taken and I was guided toward a staircase by one of the more pleasant sights available at headquarters. Sarah Howard, an old friend of mine. Don't get involved in that, John. Connor is taking a lashing from your friend, and he deserves the full treatment. She spoke with the tone of sage wisdom that often marked her statements. Although Sarah was only a secretary now, her dream was to be the city's first female police officer. Her taste in dresses ran toward simple designs in shades of green that matched her eyes. And the one she wore that day, with only a minimal bustle and not much petticoat business, showed off her tall, athletic body to advantage. Her face was by no means striking, but handsomely plain. It was the play of eyes and mouth back and forth between mischievous and sad that made it such a delight to watch her. Back in the early 70s, when I was in my teens, her family moved into a house near ours in Gramercy Park, and I'd subsequently watched her spend her single-digit years turning that decorous neighborhood into her private rumpus room. Time had not changed her much, except to make her as thoughtful and occasionally brooding as she was excitable. Following the demise of my engagement to Julia Pratt, I had one night gotten more than a little drunk, decided that all women held by society to be beauties were in fact demons, and asked Sarah to marry me. Her answer was to take me in a cab to the Hudson River and throw me in. "Sarah, I am glad to see you." We climbed the stairs. Teddy's been in one of his whirlwinds over the Santorelli case. Every kind of person has been in and out. Just then, Theodore's voice came booming down from the second-story hallway. "And don't bother bringing your friends at Tammany into this, Kelly. Tammany is a monstrous Democrat creation, and this is a reform Republican administration. You've earned no favors here with your shoulder hitting. I advise you to cooperate." Deep chuckles from a pair of voices inside the staircase were the only reply to this, and the sounds were moving our way. Within seconds, Sarah and I were face to face with the foppishly dressed, cologne-drenched, enormous figure of Biff Ellison, as well as his smaller, more tastefully clad, and less aromatic criminal overseer, Paul Kelly. Kelly greeted us amiably, the stud in his cravat gleaming as he approached. "Well, now, it's Mr. Moore of the Times, along with one of the lovely new ladies of the police department." Taking Sarah's hand, Kelly lowered his chiseled black Irish features and kissed it. "It certainly is more enjoyable getting summoned to headquarters these days." "Mr. Kelly?" His smile as he stared at Sarah was well-practiced and confident, none of which changed the fact that the air in the staircase had suddenly become charged with oppressive threat. And then he turned to me. "Biff here had nothing to do with the boy's murder, Moore, and I don't want to see my name connected with it either." "Hell of a time to think of that, Kelly. I saw his body. He was just a boy." Kelly chuckled as he took a few steps farther down the stairs. "Yes, and a boy playing a dangerous game. Come on, Moore. Boys like that die every day in this town. Why the interest? Did he have a secret relative somewhere? A bastard kid of Morgan's or Frick's?" Sarah was offended. She hadn't been working at headquarters very long. "Do you think that's the only reason the case would be investigated?" "My dear girl, both Mr. Moore and I know that's the only reason. But have it your own way. Roosevelt is championing the benighted." Kelly continued down the stairs, and Ellison pushed by me to follow. They paused a little further down, and then Kelly turned, his voice for the first time hinting at his occupation. "But I warn you, Moore, I do not want to see my name connected with this." "Don't worry, Kelly. My editors would never run the story." Kelly smiled again. "Very sensible of them, too. There are momentous things going on in the world, Moore. Why waste energy on a trifle?" And with that, they were gone. Roosevelt picked up the document from his desk. "I have your report, Kreitzler, along with the coroner's. It won't surprise you to learn that he gave us no additional insights." Kreitzler nodded in distasteful familiarity. "Any butcher or patent medicine salesman can be appointed a coroner, Roosevelt. It's almost as easy as becoming an asylum superintendent." "Indeed. At any rate, your report seems to indicate..." "It does not indicate everything I discovered. Indeed, it does not cover some of the most important points." Theodore looked up in surprise, the pince-nez that he wore in the office falling from his nose. "I beg your pardon?" Many eyes see reports at headquarters, Commissioner. I did not wish to take the chance of certain details becoming public. Not yet.
Theodore paused, his eyes narrowing pensively. You write of terrible errors.
Chrysler stood and walked to the window, pulling the shade aside just a crack.
3 years ago, when you and Moore were, I believe, in Washington, a water tower above a large tenement on Suffolk Street, just north of Delancey, was struck by lightning. The tower was the highest structure in the neighborhood, and the event was perfectly explicable, if slightly unusual. When the building's residents and the fire department reached the roof, however, some were inclined to view it as a providential event, for the tower contained the bodies of a pair of children, a brother and sister. Their throats had been cut.
It so happened that I knew the family, the Zweigs. They were Jews from Austria.
The children were quite beautiful, delicate features, enormous brown eyes, and also quite troublesome. An embarrassment to the family. They stole, lied, attacked other children. Uncontrollable. Whatever clues might have been gathered from the bodies were destroyed by another incompetent coroner. I never saw anything more than the official reports, but I did note one curious detail from those.
He pointed with his left hand to his face.
The eyes were gone.
A strong quiver went through me. Glancing at Roosevelt, I saw that he had made the connection. While his body was quite still, his eyes were wide with apprehension. He tried to battle the feeling off.
That business with the eyes is not uncommon, Chrysler, particularly if the bodies were exposed for a long period of time. And if the throats were cut, there would have been plenty of blood to attract scavengers.
But the water tower was enclosed with the exact purpose of keeping scavengers and vermin out.
I protested. The water tower or building doesn't exist that can keep certain animals out. Rats, for instance.
True, John. And in the absence of any further details, I was forced to accept that explanation. Why even New York City rats, on discovering a pair of bodies, should so carefully gnaw out only the eyes was a disturbing mystery that I tried to ignore and which remained unaddressed. Until last night.
Chrysler took to pacing the floor.
As soon as I saw the condition of the Santorelli boy, I made an examination of the ocular orbits of the skull. Working by torchlight was hardly ideal, but I found what I was looking for. On the malar bone, as well as the supraorbital ridge, were a series of narrow grooves, and on the greater wing of the sphenoid, at the base of the cavities, several small indentations, all consistent with the cutting edge and point of a knife, of the type most frequently used by hunters, I'd say. My guess would be that if we exhumed the bodies of the two 1893 victims, and I intend to request such action, we would find the same thing. In other words, gentlemen, the eyes were removed by the hand of man.
Roosevelt shifted in his chair. I could see in his face that he had run out of ways to avoid bringing Chrysler fully up to date. I feel I must tell you, Doctor, that we have had two more murders in the last 3 months that might also fit the pattern you're describing.
The statement stopped Laszlo dead in his tracks.
What? Where were the bodies found?
I'm not precisely sure.
And were they prostitutes?
I believe so, yes.
You believe so?
Records, Roosevelt. I must have the records.
Didn't anyone in this department ever think to make a connection? Didn't you?
The records were sent for. From them, we discovered that the bodies of the other two boys, both of whom had indeed been prostitutes, had also been found within what the coroners guessed were hours of their deaths. The first boy, a 12-year-old African immigrant with no known name other than Millie, had been chained to the stern of an Ellis Island ferry. And the second, a 10-year-old named Aaron Morton, had been found suspended by his feet from the Brooklyn Bridge. Both were nearly naked, both had their throats cut, along with various other bodily lacerations, and again, both were missing their eyes. As Laszlo finished reading the accounts, he mumbled that last fact to himself several times, lost in cogitation.
The eyes are the link, the key, the way in. I would stake everything on it.
He turned to us.
Even if the police had taken an interest, they would have been helpless, because they could not have begun to understand what motivates the murderer.
Do you?
Not completely. I have the first few pieces, and we must find the rest. For it is only when we truly understand what drives him that we will have even a prayer of solving this case. You must understand, Roosevelt, that the creature you seek was created long ago, perhaps in his infancy, certainly in childhood, and not necessarily here in New York.
Theodore was momentarily unable to answer, his face an open display of conflicting feelings.
Kelly has threatened to create great trouble among the immigrant communities if I try to connect Ellison or him to this case. He says he can whip up all sorts of agitation around the notion that the police department allows poor foreign children to be slaughtered with impunity.
Well, it wouldn't be difficult, since it's basically true.
Roosevelt looked sharply at Kreisler for a moment, but then softened, knowing he was right.
Tell me more. What's your opinion of Ellison? Is there any chance he is involved?
Biff?
I sat back, stretched my legs out, and waited.
He is, without question, one of the worst men in this city. But he's a stiletto man, if you know what I mean. He kills quietly, neatly. So much as I'd like to, I can't say as I see him involved in this. It's just not his style.
I glanced up to find Laszlo giving me a very puzzled look.
John, that is the most intelligent thing I've ever heard you say.
He turned to Theodore.
Roosevelt, I shall require Moore as my assistant. His knowledge of this city's criminal activities and of the locales in which those activities take place will make him invaluable.
Assistant? They both ignored me. Theodore's teeth and narrowing eyes showed that he was quite absorbed in and pleased with Kreisler's remark.
Then you wish to take part in the investigation? I sensed you would.
Take part in the investigation?
Roosevelt, have you lost your mind? An alienist? A psychologist?
You've already made an enemy of every senior officer on the force, and half the Board of Commissioners to boot. They're taking odds in the gambling halls that you'll be fired by Independence Day. If word gets out that you've brought someone like Kreisler in, why, you'd be better off hiring an African witch doctor.
Kreisler chuckled.
Which is approximately what most of our respectable citizens consider me.
Moore's right, Roosevelt. The project would have to be undertaken in absolute secrecy. What I have in mind is, an auxiliary effort. Give me 2 or 3 good young detectives with a sound appreciation of modern methods, men who have no stake in the old order of business in the department. We will set up an office outside of headquarters, though not too far away. Assign someone you trust as a liaison, against someone new, someone young. Give us all the intelligence you can without revealing the operation.
Roosevelt braced himself against his desk and rocked quietly on his chair.
Well, it would mean my job, if it were discovered. I wonder if you truly realize, Doctor, how very much your work frightens and angers the people who run this city, both its politics and its business. They seem to think what you do undermines the strength of our societal fabric. After all, the sanctity and integrity of the family, along with each individual's responsibility before God and the law for his own behavior, are twin pillars of our civilization. Moore's comment about the African witch doctor is really no joke.
But if you are sincere in your wish to stop what is happening, then you must agree.
I was still somewhat amazed by what I was hearing and thought that this would certainly be the moment when Roosevelt would stop flirting with the idea and quash it. Instead, he slammed his fist into his open hand.
By thunder, Doctor! I know of a pair of detectives that would suit your purpose down to the ground. But tell me, where would you begin?
We would begin by creating an imaginary man. Yes, an imaginary man. Now, we know nothing of the person we seek, and are unlikely ever to find witnesses who know any more than we do. Circumstantial evidence will be sparse at best. He has been at work for years, after all, and has had more than enough time to perfect his technique. What we must do, the only thing that can be done, is to paint an imaginary picture of the sort of person that might commit such acts. You see, our killer's path from birth to savagery has not been the random result of physical processes, but rather the product of conceivable events. Psychopaths are not mad. They are produced by extreme childhood environments and experiences. Judged in context, the actions of such people can be understood and even predicted. Context is the key. Every man's actions are influenced by his early experiences, and no man's behavior can be analyzed without knowledge of those experiences. Over time, patterns develop in each of our lives that eventually grow to dominate our behavior. If we could formulate a picture of the man we're after, the significance of what little evidence we collected would be dramatically magnified. We might reduce the haystack in which our needle hides to something more like a pile of straw, if you will. We have one central cause of optimism, the Santorelli boy's body, its location, and those of the other two. The killer could have gone on hiding his victims forever. God only knows how many he's killed in the last 3 years. Yet now he's given us an open statement of his activities. And in these three bodies, we may read, as clearly as if it were words, his warped cry that we find him. And find him quickly. For the timetable by which he kills is a strict one, I suspect. That timetable, too, we must learn to decipher. Then you believe you can do it quickly, Doctor? Kreitzler shrugged, seemingly unaffected by Roosevelt's urgent tone. I've given you my honest opinion. We would have a fighting chance, nothing more. Or less. And so, on that dismal March morning, Kreitzler and I became detectives. We were anxious to begin marshaling our forces for the investigation, and the delays we experienced, though brief, were frustrating. When Theodore got wind of the speculative interest in Kreitzler's visit to headquarters displayed by reporters and police officers, he realized that he'd made a mistake by holding the meeting there. He needed a couple of days to get things calmed down. In the meantime, our staff was formed. Sarah Howard was to be our liaison with headquarters. And as for our detectives, Roosevelt gave us two brothers, Marcus and Lucius Isaacson. They were Jewish immigrants in their early 30s with special training in criminal science and forensic medicine. Marcus was tall and handsome, with a strong nose, steady brown eyes, and a good head of curling hair. He was easygoing and confident. Lucius, by contrast, was short and had small eyes, thinning hair, and a fleshy face that was often beaded with sweat. He was nervous and intense. Roosevelt made a point of hiring unlikely new recruits for the force, and he was especially fond of bringing in Jews, whom he considered exceptionally honest and brave. As the days passed, Kreitzler and I used the time to make arrangements regarding our civilian occupations. I had to convince my editors to grant me a leave of absence, a goal made somewhat easier by a timely telephone call from Roosevelt. Nonetheless, I was only allowed out of the editorial offices of the Times when I pledged that if the investigation resulted in a story that was fit to print, I would not take it to another paper or magazine, regardless of how much money I was offered. I assured my sour-faced taskmasters that they wouldn't want the story anyway, and then breezed down Broadway on a typical March day in New York, 29 degrees at 11 a.m., with winds of 15 miles an hour cutting through the streets. That night, Kreitzler and I went to the opera, and afterwards we enjoyed a long and delightful dinner at Delmonico's with our new colleagues. Afterwards, in a drunken and fuzzy state, and hoping to make an inauguratory contribution to our investigation, I turned south and made for Biff Ellison's Parisis Hall. The hall's electric sign was still burning bright at close to 3 in the morning. The joint had taken its name from a patent medicine that advertised in dive toilets, promising protection and relief from the more serious social diseases. The windows of the hall were shaded, and honest citizens of the neighborhood were grateful for that fact. Inside the busy doorway, around which stood a wide range of effeminate men and boys, all of them attempting to drum up business with entering and departing customers, was a long brass-railed bar, along with a large number of round wooden tables and simple chairs of the sort that were easily broken in fights and easily replaced afterwards.
A rough stage had been built at the far end of the long, high-ceilinged room, on which more boys and men in various stages of female dress cavorted to lively yet discordant music provided by a piano, clarinet, and violin. I hadn't been inside the door 30 seconds before there was a small but strong arm around my torso and a cold piece of metal at my throat. The sudden aroma of lilac alerted me to Ellison's presence in the general area behind me, and I assumed that the metal I felt was the signature weapon of one of Biff's cronies, Razor Riley.
"I thought Kelly and me made ourselves pretty clear the other day, Moore. You gutsy or just crazy coming in here like this?"
"Neither, Biff." I spoke as clearly as extreme fear would allow. Riley was notoriously fond of cutting people up.
"I just wanted you to know that I did you a good turn."
Ellison laughed.
"You, Scribbler? What could you do for me?"
At that, he came around to face me, his ridiculous checked suit and gray bowler all reeking of cologne. He held a long, thin cigar in one beefy hand. "I told the commissioner you didn't have anything to do with it. I told him it wasn't your style." Ellison had to pause as the mass of cells that, in his case, passed for a brain, mulled this over. Then he smiled.
"Say, you're right, Moore. It ain't my style. Well, what do you know?"
"Let him go, Razor."
"Come on, Moore, I'll buy you a drink. And you can tell me how come it is you turned into my pal all of a sudden."
We stood at the bar, and I could see all the sad business of the hall reflected in a large mirror that ran along the wall behind the endless bottles of bad liquor. I ordered a beer, and the swill I was given may even have been beer, too, at some point in its existence.
"Well, Biff, what I thought was that maybe since I helped you out with the cops, you might be willing to share some information. You know, give me a hand with the story." "I don't know nothing about it, Moore. Gloria, she used to be okay, really. Hell, I let her use one of the rooms upstairs, even. But she got, troublesome. Starts asking for a bigger cut. Starts telling the other girls they ought to ask for one, too. I was gonna get rid of her. Not in any permanent meaning of the word, right? Just kick her out. Let her work the streets for a couple of weeks and see how she liked it. And then this."
He gulped his whiskey and blew cigar smoke. "The little guttersnipe had it coming, Moore."
"So that's all you can tell me?"
"That's all."
"Then maybe you'll let me take a look at the room Gloria used, just to convince me you're square."
Ellison sighed, leaning back on the bar.
"Don't push it, Moore."
5 minutes? He considered it and nodded.
5 minutes. But don't talk to nobody. Third door on your left when you get up the stairs."
I started to move away.
"Hey."
As I turned back, he handed me my beer.
"Don't abuse my hospitality, pal."
I nodded and took the beer, then pushed through the crowd to a staircase at the back of the hall. Several boys and men approached me, seeing my evening suit and smelling money. They propositioned me with every conceivable line, some running their hands along my chest and thighs. But I put a good grip on my billfold and stayed on course to the staircase, trying to keep the physically repellent suggestions with which I was peppered from registering in my mind. The inside of the staircase was unlit, but the glow of the hall crept in enough to let me see where I was going. The old, colorless paint on the walls was peeling badly, and as I mounted the first step, I heard a grunting sound coming from behind me. Looking into a dark recess on the other side of the doorway, I saw the faint outlines of a youth, his face shoved up against the wall, and another, an older man, who was pressing against the youth's naked backside. With a shudder that made me trip, I turned away and hurried up the stairs, pausing once I was in the bare second-floor hall to take a big belt of beer. Calming a bit, but beginning to wonder about the wisdom of my initiative, I found the third door on the left. I grabbed the knob, but then thought to knock. I was surprised when a boy's voice responded.
"Who is it?"
I opened the door slowly. There was nothing in the room but an old bed and a night table next to it. The paint on the walls was a red that had turned brown. There was a small window that looked out on the blank brick wall of the building next door, across about 10 feet of alley space. On the bed sat a flaxen-haired kid, maybe 15. his face painted much as Giorgio Santarelli's had been. He wore a sheer linen shirt with lace cuffs and collar, and some theatrical tights. The makeup around his eyes was smudged. He'd been crying.
"I'm not working right now. Maybe you could come back in an hour or so."
He strained to reach a falsetto pitch. "Oh, that's all right. I'm not..."